Good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is the development of the conservative halakha. Last time, we discussed the history of the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is an intellectual institution, the fountainhead, the academy of the movement, except that it wasn't. As I said for about half the lecture last time, the seminary did its best to dissociate itself as much as it could for the longest time from the conservative movement. And only in the 1970s did it finally open up to the truth that there was a school, a rabbinical organization, and a union of synagogues, and they're all cooperating together for the sake of advancing one denomination in Jewish life. So today we're going to focus on the rabbinical arm of that tripartite entity. From the beginnings of the historical school, or the positive historical Judaism, which is a forerunner to conservative Judaism, there was an ambiguity about the halakha. Is it fully binding? Every last little detail? Is it generally binding? Is it not binding at all? Simply we choose to abide by it out of old time's sake. What is the attitude of the middle-of-the-road school of Judaism towards the details of Jewish law? Well, it was convenient for the scholars who taught at Breslau and who taught in New York at JTS to avoid the subject. The curriculum did not emphasize the halakha. The curriculum emphasized Talmud, yes, but also Bible and other subjects, and not necessarily rigorous training in the codes, in the halakhic codes. And the professors had their specialties that they focused on, and it was not writing responsa literature, as you would expect from the Gedolim of the Orthodox world, who write Shailus Tshuvos. But the rabbis who are graduated from these institutions and go off to serve in the field are running congregations that have questions. How do we function? Can we do this? Can we not do this? So they need answers. And in the absence of answers from the top, what do people do? They make it up as they go along. All right, and so there is anarchy within the camp of nascent conservative Judaism on issues of synagogue policy and the broader issues of halakha. Salman Schechter was well aware of this. Cyrus Adler was well aware of this. Louis Ginsburg was well aware of this. They were not happy about it. They would have preferred if their graduates, their Talmidim, who were out in the field, were hewing closely to the traditional line, but that wasn't happening, at least not in every situation. In fact, it usually wasn't happening. No, this is already much earlier. This is in 19-teens. There are already synagogues that have mixed pews. There are synagogues where the chazan is facing forward. There are synagogues that are thinking about abolishing the second day of Yom Tov. There are synagogues that have the triennial reading of the Torah, the three-year cycle of the Torah.
And this is not reform.
And this is not reform. These are synagogues that are affiliated with the United Synagogue who hire rabbis who are graduates of the Jewish Theological Seminary. So they are clearly not identifying as reform, yet they are adopting religious policies that in the past have been associated with reform and as being contrary to the Orthodox point of view. All right, with the invention of electricity, there are synagogues that are introducing microphones. Okay.
Any of the rabbis at that time, Orthodox rabbis?
Oh, sure. But not in congregations that are adopting some of these changes. There are JTS graduates who are loyal disciples of Schechter and Ginsburg and who are loyal to their alma mater, who themselves are very, very pious, and whose congregations have not changed all that much, although likely they may have adopted mixed seating or have gotten rid of the mechitza and maybe even mixed seating, because the two are not the same thing. It's one thing to have separate with no barrier. It's quite another to have actual mixing in one pew.
Huh? We had a few in the Bronx where we had the rabbi came in, a brilliant conservative guy, while he was something graduate ever. He broke the microphone.
Broke the microphone. Yeah, good for him. Good for him.
Yeah.
Did these young rabbinic graduates, were they encouraged, discouraged, or get no guidance at all in terms of calling their mentors.
Okay, good, good, good. So the answer to that is that for the most part, they were on their own. They may have called privately upon their mentor for some guidance, but they need a job. And the synagogues develop in whatever way they develop, with or without rabbinic guidance or approval. And if these men want positions and they want to be employed, they have to go with the flow sometimes. Because remember, in the early days of the seminary, it was far from clear that there were enough congregations out there who fit this bill, who were neither Reform nor immigrant Orthodox. You need a middle-of-the-road synagogue, and the rabbi needs work. So, in 1917, at the United Synagogue Convention, it is suggested that there be established a committee, an authoritative committee on Jewish law, that will issue rulings for how synagogues that are affiliated with that union should operate on the major religious questions. And Louis Ginsberg objected to that. Ginsberg at the time was the president of the United Synagogue, and he said, we cannot have that, because America is a land of separation of church and state. Each synagogue is free to do whatever it wants. We cannot coerce anyone to behave religiously in the way that we see fit. They're going to do what they see fit. So at best, what can we have? A committee on the interpretation of Jewish law. Not an authoritative one, but a committee on interpretation, which will receive the questions, the shaylot that come from the field, and we will give guidance. We will give it to Teshuvah, which is not binding. It may be morally binding, but we're not going to issue sanctions on any house of worship for failing to abide by them. Of course, then of what use is the question and answer? Well, if the questioner is sincere in their quest for guidance, maybe they will follow it. And if not, if it's a bluff, then they'll do whatever they feel like. And as for the answer, you could throw it in the garbage. So,
the question comes from the rabbis or from the shuls?
So usually it came from the shuls, not from the rabbis. Sometimes from the rabbis, but oftentimes, more than often, it was from the synagogue, and they want to know, can we institute the following policy for the shul? As opposed to a question about the minutiae of private observance, which might come from a rabbi. I mean, it might come from a private individual too, but more likely a question about personal observance is a rabbi's type question, not a synagogue union type question. Yeah.
Isn't it curious that they wouldn't ask their own rabbi for guidance
on how to deal with them? So, the individual, the power of the individual rabbi to answer serious religious questions is entirely dependent upon the seriousness with which he was educated as a halakhic scholar, which unfortunately at that time was left much to be desired. We're going to see that qualifications play a major role. The qualification of the individual rabbi is a real problem.
So what you're saying essentially is that it was the board of directors that would generate these questions to the central body then.
Yeah, oftentimes, yes. There will be, soon, we'll see that, yeah.
I don't understand that. I mean, look, all the separate shouts and shuvas, there were rabbanim were writing letters to these gedolim who then published their shouts and shuvas.
So bear in mind, the gedolim of the old world are miles and miles away from this world that we're talking about now, this Americanized synagogue.
What about Rav Moshe Zatzal? I mean, he was here. He was.
No. This is well before Rav Moshe. It's well before Rav Moshe.
I understand, but the shaykhs that he got were not from Balabatim. They were from Rabbanim.
Okay. So, yeah.
Later on, because they needed a job, and so BYU graduates of the rabbis took jobs.
Yep.
Would they not write, would they not have a mentor?
So typically those kind of rabbis were not looking to the official arms of the conservative movement for guidance. They were looking either to their own teachers or to nobody at all, because they found themselves in a very uncomfortable position of having gone against their own team, but they're not part of the other team. They're nowhere. and they're an island unto themselves. There were many in the 50s and 60s. There were many Orthodox rabbis and conservative shuls who could turn to nobody for guidance because they had put themselves in a situation where they were in no man's land. Okay, let me just continue. So in 1917, they established this Committee on Interpretation of Jewish Law. Louis Ginsburg is the chairman, and the other members are certainly not lightweights. They are heavyweights within this world of the conservative rabbinate. Men like Louis Epstein, okay, and Max Drob, who was a rabbi actually in the Bronx at that time. So Boaz Cohen will become the chairman in the 1930s, yes, to become a very important figure. So in the period between 1917 and 1927, when Ginsburg is the chairman of this committee, they never issue a ruling which is contrary to Orthodox practice. Never. And that is annoying from the perspective of those who are looking for change, who are looking for a heter, who are looking for a leniency with which to build their synagogue and build their movement. But it's not forthcoming. Why? Because, first of all, everybody on the committee deferred to Ginsburg, since he was the Gadol HaDor from their perspective. He was the great scholar. And he is a very traditional fellow. He believed that the Talmud is the final authority, as opposed to the Shulchan Aruch being the final authority. So he was willing to rule against the Achronim. He would disregard the post-Shulchan Aruch literature, and he would focus on the correct understanding of the Gemara itself, the words of the Gaonim, of which he was an expert, and in the literature of the Rishonim. So in this respect, he actually was like the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was known for being a maverick and that he would rule against his predecessors in the Achronic period and go back to much earlier sources. And when I say Ginsburg was like the Vilna Gaon, he was also related to the Vilna Gaon. He was a Ben Achar Ben of six generations from the Vilna Gaon's brother. And he would write that on the cover page of all of his works, that he has Yichus, Ben Achar Ben, from the Ach Shel Vilna Gaon Mivilna. But even though he was a bit of a maverick in his style of jurisprudence, the end result was always a traditional one. And in the good tradition of the historical school, he cares not so much about absolute halakha, sort of divine law, but rather the historical precedent of Jewish practice in the Jewish world, in the traditional Jewish world. So he couldn't care less what the irreligious Jews do. He cares what the religious Jews do. And for example, prohibition, the issue of grape juice. Sacramental wine is a shanda. People, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, people are getting smicha from bogus sources so that they could issue permits for sacramental wine. And it was a chil Hashem that people who were nobodies, who were not religious functionaries, were passing themselves off as that in order to get involved in the booze trade. Well, with a religious cover to it. So Ginsburg was asked about grape juice, and he ruled in a 50-page Hebrew responsum that grape juice is permitted. This was the only one that he wrote, in actually one of only two responses that he wrote in Hebrew. Everything else he ever wrote was in English, on practical halakha l'maaseh. He wrote it in Hebrew to try to convince the Orthodox, his colleagues in the Agudas Rabbanim, that he's right. Now, when I say he used the historical method for the tshuva on grape juice, it means that at the end of the day, last couple of pages, he says, you know, in Lithuania, where there are many frum people, those are his words, they use raisin wine, unfermented raisin wine, which is the functional equivalent of grape juice, unfermented juice. And if they can do it in Lithuania, it must mean that it's okay. Now, what kind of a posek writes along those lines? Nobody. That's not a standard method for the Orthodox Psak Halacha. But in the historical school, and it's a traditional wing of the historical school, you point to a community that is known for its piety and say, hey, if it was good enough for them, it's good enough for us. Okay.
That took 50 pages?
Yes. So actually, I read the whole thing.
How could he squeeze
How could he squeeze? Yeah, so I read the whole thing cover to cover when I was in grad school, and it happens to be a very impressive tshuva. It's all about yain migito, wine from your own from the vat, from the vineyard, from the press. It's intense stuff that unless you have Talmudic training in Masechet Avodah Zarah, you're not going to be able to follow it. But so he's playing to the Orthodox Rabbonim, to the Agudas Rabbonim. He wants to convince them that he's right, even though he's Louis Ginsburg and a professor at JTS, and they might think he's an apikoros. Still, an apikoros is right. You know, a broken clock is right twice a day. They really didn't care. They didn't care.
It was a Yayin Nesach issue?
It wasn't a Yayin Nesach issue. It was an issue of whether or not there's a mitzvah min hamuvchar, a preference for fermented wine, or an absolute requirement for fermented wine. And he came to the conclusion that there's absolutely no requirement. And even mitzvah min hamuvchar is only a position of the Magen Avraham, and he says the Magen Avraham was wrong. Okay.
So now that grape juice is accepted in our community,
right.
Is that relying on his psak din?
I don't think so, but it helps.
Somebody else has it to go along the same line.
So, yes. So Moses Chaimson, who was the professor of halacha at JTS, but was an Orthodox rabbi, the rabbi at Or HaChaim on the Upper East Side, and dying in England before coming to America, a reputable figure in the Orthodox world, he also paskened at the very same time in the 1920s that grape juice was permitted. So if you didn't think that Ginsburg was a good enough a source for the halacha, Chaimson was for sure good enough.
But did he use the same lines of reasoning? That's what I don't
know. I don't know. I didn't read his writings. Okay. So what are some of the questions that are emerging in the 1920s for which there are no good answers or answers that the people want to hear?
Cars.
Okay, so cars actually doesn't come up until 1932 and they don't really address it until 1950. And we're going to spend a whole week, 2 weeks from now, on that topic. So mixed seating, we're going to spend the whole session next week on the issue of, actually, no, we'll do Laguna next week. We'll do, in 2 weeks, we'll do mixed seating.
What about divorce?
Aguna, we're going to discuss Aguna. It's going to have a whole week on it. All right, but mixed seating. So Ginsburg doesn't like mixed seating, but the people want it. And the question keeps coming up. And over the span of 25 years, from 1921 to 1946, his position evolves, but not by much. And so that even by the 1940s, he's still really opposed, despite the fact that 95 or 97% of the conservative synagogues had mixed seating, which means that he's out of touch or out of step with the laity. Now that's a recipe for disaster.
Did they have total mixed seating or just normal pizza?
Each place had its own story. But the point is, what Ginsburg wanted wasn't what the Oilam was doing. Which means, Ginsburg's committee is not long for this earth. It can't continue if the answers he's giving are not reflective of what the people need. Okay.
But in addition to that, he's only a person that will one day die, and who will take him to the vacuum?
Well, there were successors to Ginsburg who were very traditionalist in character, who actually do play a role in the decade or so after he's ousted from the picture. But even their efforts are rejected as being insufficiently progressive, and so they get pushed aside in 1948, which we'll see in a few minutes. So in 1927, in Atlantic City, at the annual convention of the Rabbinical Assembly, which is now gaining in strength, they decide to take the law committee out of the hands of the United Synagogue, which really, although it's a layman's organization, was really in the hands of the seminary professors, namely Ginsburg, take it away from them and arrogate that power to the rabbis, to the graduates, who are functioning out in the congregations. The Rabbinical Assembly will create their own committee on Jewish law. Ginsburg sees what's going on, and he's very nervous, because he knows that he can't rely upon his disciples, who are not really so much his disciples as just they graduated from his institution. He can't rely upon them to preserve the halakha in the way he sees is the correct and proper way, the traditional halakha. He knows that they're itching for radical changes that he would never countenance. And so in a last-ditch attempt, he says to them, "Hands off the law! Hands off the law!" In a very bitter speech at Atlantic City, 1927. And then he departs stage left. Okay? Who takes over? So they need to establish a committee that will satisfy the various factions within the movement, because there's diversity of religious belief, of theological belief about the origins of the law, the divinity of the Torah, and the like. And there's also a similar divide along how to progress halakhically, whether to be with fealty to the Shulchan Aruch or to go in whatever direction you feel like. So there's also a centrist faction that is neither here nor there, and is waiting to see which side wins, and they'll go with the winner. Who's in which camp? So Mordechai Kaplan, of course, is the leader of the progressives, of the left-wingers, who want to see halakha destroyed. That's not to say they want to see Judaism destroyed. No, far from it. But they want to see the notion of a binding law disregarded in the conservative movement, and to have people accept religious observance not because it's an imposed law from up above, but rather it's our cultural folkways that we take upon ourselves out of the goodness of our heart, out of our Jewish commitment. Very nice, but not the traditional way of thinking about things. The right-wingers are led by Louis Epstein, who's a rabbi in Brookline, Massachusetts, Max Drab of New York, and a few other good scholarly individuals. And the middle faction is Louis Finkelstein. Louis Finkelstein, who is rising through the ranks of the seminary professorate and eventually will become the chancellor, he says, I don't oppose other people's attempts at change. I simply don't support it now because I'm waiting on the sidelines to see if it is successful. How are revolutions legitimate? When they're successful. If they're unsuccessful, they were illegitimate. So the centrist point of view is, I don't call for any change, but if it happens and everybody goes along with it, then a few decades later I'll accept it post facto. All right.
Does anyone talk about God?
Yes. So, yes, the answer is yes. Every time there's a discussion of halakhic policy, or at least almost every time, there is a parallel discussion about theology and about the origins of the law and what makes it binding. And some of the right-wingers used this type of language when they challenged the left-wing. They said, my grandfather and my father in Poland and in Russia didn't freeze on Friday night because of some ethnic folkway from 3,000 years ago in the Middle East. They froze because God told them to. Well, all right, but my point, the point they were trying to make is when people sacrifice, when they sacrifice physical comfort and material well-being for the sake of a religious tradition, they do so because they thought God wanted it, not because it was some ethnic folkway. It's one thing to shake a lulav and an esrog that you bought for $10 on the street corner because it's no harm, no foul. But to bear the burden of the onerous aspects of religious tradition, you would only do that if God wanted it, not because it was a folkway. That's their point. Yeah.
I don't understand the brouhaha over rules and regulations.
Okay, that's the biggest question of this whole topic. Why discuss it if nobody's religious? So the answer is that, well, there are two parts to the answer. One is that the rabbis themselves need permission for their own lawbreaking. Not the layman's lawbreaking, their own lawbreaking, that the rabbis in the conservative movement, many of them were simply not observant. Yes, yes, this is the open secret of for two-thirds of the 20th century, that, and this was clear, at JTS there was Shachris Mincha Maariv, wasn't well attended. And if the Talmidim were not going when they were Talmidim, Alachas Kama Vakama, when their rabbis in the field and the professors aren't watching them. And the rabbis were driving to shul on Shabbos, some of them. Now, when I say this, I'm not saying across the board. I'm not being disparaging every last conservative rabbi. I'm saying there were people who were doing these things. There were people who were being machal yontif in various ways. There were people who were not keeping kosher very so scrupulously in the rabbinate. Okay, Solomon Goldman of Chicago was simply not religious, and he was a major conservative rabbi.
All right. I don't understand the difference between conservative and reformed based on that statement.
All right, I'm giving you examples of people who were individuals on the fringe who were not so religious, or who were not on the fringe, but who privately were not so scrupulous in their observance. And they're looking for ways out of difficult situations. But there's another factor altogether. It has nothing to do with the rabbis, it has to do with the lay people. The lay people don't want to feel guilty. If the lay people don't want to feel guilty, then you have one of two options. Either become more religious, or justify irreligion. Yes. So justifying irreligion in order to assuage the guilt feelings of leading members of the laity becomes an important reason to engage in this intellectual pursuit, despite the fact that really it's pointless. And it's not me in 2018 making this point. Chairman of the law committee over the decades made that very same point, that we're engaging in this big enterprise, intellectual enterprise, but for what reason? Why? Where are the people in all this? They're not listening to us, so why should we bother? And the answer is, well, we continue to do it because we've always been doing it and because we want to assuage guilt feelings and give rabbis a little guidance. Yeah.
Martin Buber told my Rav, uh-huh, who said to the pulpit that the biggest mistake of the conservative movement is making it easy.
Well, that's true. Went from Kula to Carlos Roche, right, Alan?
And I don't know about Buber's.
I wouldn't take Buber. I don't trust Buber on anything because he didn't daven. Yeah.
I went to the Jewish Theological Seminary.
Yes.
1960. Ah. Uh-huh.
Ah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Sure. Absolutely.
Students.
Yes. Yes. That's absolutely the case. Who were graduates of Yeshiva College. So, in the 1930s, the big question that the Jewish Law, Committee on Jewish Law was addressing was the Aguna. And next time we'll discuss it at length. But suffice it to say that the Aguna question was a real-life question that the rabbis had to deal with, women who were suffering. But the women who were suffering were very small in number. Very, very, very small number of agunas who suffered. What did most agunas do?
Got married.
They got married. They didn't suffer. Okay? Simple as that.
Their husbands suffered.
I don't know about that, but the point is, people who had halachic problems did not necessarily let those problems interfere with the ordinary functioning of life. And so the rabbis who wanted to address these problems and solve them with a halachic solution were oftentimes dealing with a phantom. In other words, yes, the problem exists, but it only exists in the abstract, because in the real world, people simply don't care. They've moved on. But the rabbis don't like that. They want to have a real solution, at least an intellectual solution, to what should have been a real problem.
What years?
30s, 40s, 50s.
So you had the Second World War, where that may have been a... Yeah.
Even World War I made an important impact upon that. Okay. What else? What other questions? Can a Kohen marry a divorcee? Can a Kohen marry a convert? All right? We need a liberal answer here. Can a rabbi who's a Kohen officiate at a funeral? That's a big one.
Money.
Okay, because there's money involved, but there's also, what if you're the only rabbi in town? And you're a musmach of JTS, all right, and you're the only rabbi in town. Your people need you, but your last name is Cohen or Katz or Kaplan, and there's a Leviah. What do you do? We need a lenient answer. Okay, is sturgeon kosher? Is swordfish kosher? Is gelatin kosher? All these questions are coming up. And we need answers. But the answers were not progressive enough. And so the people of the left wing was unhappy. Even the centrists were unhappy. So in 1948, there's a revolution. The Revolution of 48. In Chicago, in March of 1948, a new committee is established. The Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. What's the difference between law and standard?
It's the red line.
So standard could be a red line.
Community.
It could be a red line that you're not allowed to cross. However, it could also be a good 10 feet south of the law. In other words, the law is here, and you really shouldn't go south of the law. But we'll say the standard is down here, and don't go south of that. If the pre-1948 committee, led by the likes of Boaz Cohen, Louis Epstein, Max Straub, were not willing to countenance departures from Shulchan Aruch Judaism, from Halachic Judaism, then the post-1948 committee was willing to do so and to issue takanot, enactments, ordinances that will give permission to do things that the strict letter of the law would never have allowed. So who are the important figures on this new committee? And the seminary professors were kicked out. Boaz Cohen was kicked out unceremoniously, gone, after 16 years of being the posek for the movement. He said, "You goodbye, we don't want you anymore." Boaz Cohen was a hero. All right, Rav Soloveitchik accepted Boaz Cohen's gittin because Boaz Cohen was a scholar and a gentleman.
Wasn't this right after the establishment of the adoption of a conservative prayer book?
Yes, okay, so Morris Silverman put out the prayer book in 1946, and Louis Ginsburg, was solicited for his opinion about it, and Silverman didn't take those opinions seriously, and he put out the prayer book, and Ginsburg viciously criticized it as being dreck. Of course, in the conservative movement, the Silverman prayer book was used until they put out the Sim Shalom in 1986. So for those shuls that didn't use Philip Birnbaum, okay, the Birnbaum was common in many places, but for those real conservative shuls, not the conservadox shuls, that used Silverman for four decades, that was the main prayer book. And Ginsburg said this is junk.
Wasn't there Gordas came out with a book in
the Boxer came out with one in the 60s.
Gordas,
I don't think so. Boxer came out with 61, and it was not widely accepted because it was hardly any different from Birnbaum. It looked the same, too. Silverman. Silverman made the Korbanos into the past tense. Past tense. Not looking forward to the future restoration, but rather they were of the past. She'asu, yeah. The Ishei Yisrael Tfilatam. It was just Tfilatam.
Right. So that was the Silverman.
That was the Silverman, correct. Okay, so who were the important players post-48? Morris Adler, who I have mentioned in the past as being famous for what? The only rabbi to be assassinated at his own pulpit. All right, Theodore Friedman and Jacob Agus. So these three giants, Friedman, Adler, Agus, were the authors of the infamous Driving Responsum, which we'll spend a week on in about 3 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now. In 1950, it was declared that you're allowed to drive to shul on Shabbos. You can't do anything else? Huh?
Your closest shul, right?
Huh?
Wasn't it your closest shul?
You can drive to... Yes. The assumption was it's the closest shul, but only there and nowhere else.
And home.
To shul and home. And also, in a response written by Arthur Newlander, electricity is permitted on Shabbos for things that are not otherwise forbidden, which means you can't cook and you can't shave, but you can turn the lights on, okay? Or the TV.
Wow.
No, that's not him. That's not him. In Cherry Hill, that was... Yeah, it may be a relative, but it wasn't Arthur Newlander. No, that was years later.
So you could drive, but you couldn't carry it, is that right?
Okay, so when we discuss the driving tshuva, we'll deal with the opposition to that tshuva on the grounds that driving to shul involves more than just the combustion engine of the car. It involves carrying, it involves a lot of muksa, it involves the lights in the car. There's a lot of stuff going on when it comes to the operating of a motor vehicle other than simply the fact that you went from here at point A to point B.
We had a bus years ago.
Huh? Yeah,
the Sephardic Temple had a bus.
Yeah, yeah.
Had a bus on
the Shabbos.
Yeah. So in 1973, the conservative rabbi at the breakaway shul in Jacksonville, Florida, stopped by a policeman on Shabbos, and he was arrested because he had no idea.
Right, no ID, yeah. it's terrible.
So essentially what you are saying is you set up one rule, and then you have to build a whole set of halachas around that rule.
Yes, that's true, except they don't. It becomes a sort of a free-for-all. There's the one leniency, and the fact that leniency creates a host of other problems is largely ignored. Okay, now let's just continue a little bit. So, after 1950, there's progress. women's aliyot are theoretically permitted in 1955, and we're going to spend a week on egalitarianism. So it wasn't widely accepted. It was not until the mid-70s that it was widely accepted, and even then, many conservative synagogues delayed implementation until the 80s or 90s. However, as early as 1955, there was at least theoretical egalitarianism with regard to aliyot. Other areas of halakha that were liberalized were kashrus, and areas related to Isser v'heter, but the major question that remained outstanding was the Aguna and the second day Yom Tov. It was not until 1969 the Aguna issue was resolved, and when we discuss the Aguna at length, I'll explain how they resolved it, but just I'll regalach the 10-second version, to annul previously done marriages where the husband is a recalcitrant guy on the grounds that it was a mekach ta'ut, it was a bad acquisition because who knew the guy was such a bastard. And for forward-looking marriages, there'd be a stipulation, a tanai, benisuin, this is a conditional marriage on condition that everybody behave themselves and not become a recalcitrant spouse.
That sounds like what Rabbi Billet instituted with the a prenuptial agreement.
It's close to that, but not exactly. Okay, we're going to spend a long time on that. Yes, it's problematic for a range of reasons. We'll have to, you come back next week. The Lieberman clause. Let's address that now. The rabbinical assembly between 48 and 70 was active. They were giving heterim leniencies in the law, and the seminary was scared out of their mind. Why? Because the seminary is too closely associated with their alumni, with the rabbinical assembly. And if the alumni are going off the reservation on halachic matters, then the seminary will no longer be held in high regard by the traditional Jewish world. So they tried to stifle halachic creativity on the part of their alumni. And whereas in 48 they gave permission, you want to go it alone, go it alone. In 52, Louis Finkelstein, behind the scenes, in a very surreptitious and little dubious way, pulled the rug out from underneath them and said, you know what, we need to collaborate together, seminary and rabbinical assembly, on a joint law conference. Not a separate assembly law committee, but a joint law conference with the professors involved, including Saul Lieberman, who was the Gadol Hador of their crowd, and the greatest Talmudist of the 20th century, and nobody could argue with him, okay, because he knows more than anybody else. So they want a joint effort. And they produced the Lieberman Ketubah, which is a clause in the Ketubah that says you'll come to the Beit Din of the JTS for adjudication in moment of marital crisis. We'll discuss it at length. The main point for tonight is that the seminary doesn't trust their alumni. They can't go it alone. If they go it alone, they'll become reform. Louis Finkelstein simply did not have any respect for the religious scruples of those whom he graduated. It's a rough thing to say. It's very sad. You're right. It is very sad, but it's absolute truth. Yeah.
What about the conservative population? Did anybody address them? Nobody was showing up, except for once or this.
No. The attendance was good in the 50s. Synagogues were full in the 50s. Post-war, they had a crowd. But as Heschel would say, attendance in the synagogue didn't mean that they were spiritually attuned or that Judaism was doing well. Jewish institutions were doing well. Synagogues had paying members and even people who showed up. But it doesn't mean that the religion of Judaism was really vibrant. And he was right, because that was a That's right.
Public schools. The best public schools that there were, that's where they went. And the yeshivas were of no concept. Yeshivas were an Orthodox preserve.
True. No.
When did they stop Salman Schechter?
Salman Schechter's began in the 50s, but they were few and far between.
They had Hebrew schools that confirmed the kids.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay. So now let's, in the time we have left, I want to examine five reasons why a movement that theologically had departed from orthodoxy long before took a very long time before it was ready for maverick halachic decisions. Because it's not until the 70s that the conservative movement is flagrantly and openly at odds with the orthodox world. That up until the 70s, even a shul that didn't have a mechitza largely had a traditional service, and a rabbi who looked like a properly functioning rabbi, and there was a feeling of traditional religion about that synagogue, in most conservative synagogues, which was largely lost from the 70s and onward. And it's reflected in the absence of maverick decisions before that point, and the plethora of maverick decisions afterward on egalitarianism, women rabbis, homosexuality, even this talk of intermarriage, patrilineal descent, all sorts of discussions that would be unthinkable in the earlier period are now fair game since the 70s and onward. So why is that the case? Let me give five explanations. One, the relationship with the Orthodox world. So for many decades, in the early part of the 20th century, through the mid-century, conservative rabbis had one of three possible relationships with the Orthodox. One possibility is they were Orthodox, meaning the far right wing, although they had graduated from JTS and had accepted, you know, Schechter and Ginsburg as their rebbeim, or Lieberman as their rebbe, they were basically Orthodox people in theology and in practice. Okay, it's still true for those from that era who are still around that they're effectively Orthodox. Second point, there were those who feared antagonizing the Orthodox with too liberal of a ruling, because what would happen then is they would lose credibility within the traditional world. If the Orthodox Rabbanim were to castigate them publicly or to issue a cherem against them in a community where the laity is conservadox, if the Orthodox rabbi calls the conservative rabbi a heretic and throws him out of the community, it can have real consequences. So you don't want to have a bitter relationship with the fellow to your right. Therefore, don't do anything too objectionable. Hold back. Even though maybe personally you would want to do something more progressive, you hold back in deference to those who are a little more frum. And the third possibility is the desire for cooperation, especially in areas of hilchot ishut, of personal status, marriage and divorce. There were various attempts to have collaboration between the RA and the RCA, especially in the 1950s, in the days of Rabbi Theodore Adams and his leadership of the RCA in the mid 1955-56 especially. But there was also attempts earlier, in the days of Louis Epstein, trying to collaborate with the Agudas Rabbanim. It was a failed effort. It was always a failed effort. There was never success in the attempts to have halakhic cooperation between conservative and Orthodox figures. It was attempted, but never successfully. But the fact that it was even attempted meant that the conservatives had to hold back a little bit.
Who's on the New York Board of Rabbis? Are they involved today?
Yes, but that's just for publicity purposes and for chaplaincy. It's not for any halakhic issues.
Okay,
chaplaincy is a big deal. Okay, so the relationship with the Orthodox is one. Secondly, competence. If a person is going to be involved in tinkering with the halakha of, let's say, gittin, divorce, and making changes that are supposedly necessary in the environment of 20th century America, wouldn't it make sense that he could only do that if he was already involved in traditional gittin? But if he were not, then he's a complete outsider who has no basis even to make an effort. Or kashrus. Let's say I don't do hashkacha, but rather somebody, the other guy does hashkacha. The fellow with the long beard does hashkacha, and the clean-shaven rabbi from JTS doesn't do hashkacha. Now all of a sudden the clean-shaven JTS rabbi wants to say that swordfish is kosher, or that you can eat vegetables and fish in a non-kosher restaurant if you just clean the grill? Which was, by the way, one of the big issues. Can you eat in a treif restaurant if the ingredients are kosher? That was one of the major questions that they faced in the 20s, the 30s, and 40s. So, who was handling kashrus and gittin in America? Orthodox rabbis. So they did a survey in the late 30s of the members of the rabbinical assembly. What do you do when a congregant needs a divorce? And the overwhelming majority of them said, oh, we pass it off to the Orthodox rabbi in town who's a member of the Agudas Rabbanim.
Wow.
They didn't do it themselves. So how could the RA change laws of gittin if they don't even do gittin? And why don't they do gittin? Because they're not competent. Because did they learn Hilchus Gittin? Did they learn Masechta Gittin? Did they learn Evin HaEzer in the Shulchan Aruch? No! So, all right, so for some who were traditionally minded, they didn't want the heavy responsibility because they took it seriously and they recognized their standing and they said, you know what, better to go to someone who's qualified. But even for those who were not traditionally minded, they simply were not involved. Yeah.
Because it made sense. Would it have been accepted? It wouldn't have been accepted. So why would somebody go to a conservative rabbi?
Well, let's say your own rabbi is a conservative rabbi. You remember a conservative shul, United Synagogue, Rabbinical Assembly rabbi, but you want to get a divorce.
If he does it wrong, so, he couldn't have mamzerus there.
Okay, so the fact that he could do it wrong is a problem, is a worry, but from the rabbi's point of view, many of them simply abdicated responsibility because they felt that this was not their bailiwick, this is not what they do. Now, why not? Because they weren't trained to do it. Why were they not trained to do it? Because rabbinical seminaries of the heterodox variety, since they were founded in the 19th century, never taught that kind of material. They were never producing people with hatarat hora'ah, the so-called real smicha, which we mentioned last time.
Did their constituency go to a rabbi for a get? They got divorced, they just got divorced civil.
But let's say the congregant did care.
Probably
didn't care. You're right. Okay.
But this is not different from going to a doctor.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if I go to my gastroenterologist because I have a heart problem,
right,
he'll pass me off to a...
Correct.
So in this case, it's almost okay. The same thing.
So, now, because this was the common practice of passing off complex halakhic matters to the Orthodox... Some members of the rabbinical assembly complained that we're being graduated as nursemaids and social workers, not as real rabbis. And if you're going to make us into a rabbi, let us do all the things that rabbis need to do. Of course, the ones who were traditionally minded would say, well, let us first learn all the necessary material, and then we'll do what we need to do. The ones who couldn't care less would say, even from ignorance, we'll do whatever we need to do. So, it's, as rabbi, teacher, and preacher in Israel, but not with Hatarat Hora'ah. So, they actually did another survey in the late 30s, asking around the rabbinical assembly, how many of you have a traditional smicha from some other source? And it was estimated that about 20% of the members of the assembly did have some other kind of ordination in addition to their diploma from JTS. But even they... we're not necessarily involved in complex matters of hashkacha on food, on restaurants or catering halls, not on Erevin and not on Gittin. Those are the big areas of complex halacha, Erevin, Kashrus, and Gittin. The one area that they did do, despite its complexity, was conversion. And conversion becomes a problem because the Orthodox start rejecting any conversions done by graduates of JTS who are members of the Rabbinical Assembly. And Boaz Cohen complained. So, the conversion is one siman in Shulchan Aruch. There's no tractate. It's siman Reish Samach Ches in Yoredeya. But Boaz Cohen complained. He said, it's wrong. The Orthodox are wrong. It's against halacha what they're doing because they're rejecting a valid ger, that our gerim are legit, it's done properly, and it's against the Torah. It's against the Torah to mistreat a righteous ger just on the basis of party affiliation of the rabbi who did the conversion. So so Boaz Cohen, right in the 30s and 40s, does not accept the idea that the conservative movement is, by definition, halakhically invalid. He works with the premise that we're traditional people, we're doing the right thing, we're trying our best, and the Orthodox should not automatically disqualify us. They can disqualify individual rabbis on the basis of being bad actors, being mekalkalim, the ones who do it wrong. There are plenty of mekalkalim out there in the world, and when it comes to conversion. But if you do it right, it shouldn't matter where the rabbi graduated from. So since the days of Rav Moshe Psak, we have a sort of across-the-board rule that anything done by the conservatives is bogus. Bein l'kula, bein l'chumra. Okay? So, that's the issue of qualifications. The third factor is the seminary. The seminary was a force to be reckoned with by the rabbinical assembly, preventing them from acting independently on matters of Jewish law.
It should be noted that the seminary synagogue, up until not too long ago,
had separate seating.
It was an Orthodox synagogue, plain pure and public.
So the seminary synagogue was under the auspices of Saul Lieberman for several decades, and he was, of course, a religious Jew to the fullest, and would not allow any departure from Orthodox brand of worship. When he died in 1983, then things changed. Then the main service was moved upstairs into the room paid for by the Women's League. And the downstairs room, the Stein Chapel, became just the small minion for the traditionalists. And I remember in 2002, 3, 4, when I used to go to JTS regularly to do research, so I would go mincha over there, and who was davening there? People who used the library. Religious people from other institutions who used the library would daven there with a handful of professors, and the JTS crowd, the seminary students and the liberal professors, davened upstairs in the egalitarian minion. So, the seminary wanted to maintain its position as a widely respected and accepted academic place, that nobody in the religious world, other than maybe the fundamentalist extremists, should have a problem with. That even the Orthodox should still like the seminary, the moderate Orthodox should have a respect for the seminary and its religious standards. So therefore, Louis Finkelstein, Cyrus Adler, Solomon Schechter, who are presidents and chancellors, respectively, of the institution, don't want to see their graduates engage in too much halakhic tinkering, because it will reflect badly on them. Individual professors might have had a different point of view. So if we go to individual professors, Mordechai Kaplan, who taught homiletics, was the leading radical, the leading left-winger. He wants to see massive change. Okay? Who else were the professors? Boaz Cohen was a traditionalist. Ginsburg was a traditionalist. And they didn't give answers that departed from the codes. All right?
I would sneak just for one caveat. Solomon Schechter, despite what everybody says, this I knew when I was a lawyer, there were old-time people who remembered him in this respect. He was a Kohen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they held a lot of funerals, a lot of levayas were held in the seminary, and they were still in Midtown. They were not...
They were on 59th and Lex.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And anytime there was a Leviah, he would gather up all the Talmidim.
They would walk out.
Yeah. Lead them out of the building so not to be in the building there as a funeral. You would not find that. They would not be that medallion today.
No. Tumas Kohen. The concept of Tumas Kohen was a real problem for them because there were a lot of rabbis who were Kohanim, and they basically did away with it for convenience sake. Okay. So the seminary prevented action until the seminary decided, you know what, we're going to have to go along for the ride. We're part of this movement, and whatever needs to be done, we will do. So by the 1970s, that's the case under Gerson Cohen. Gerson Cohen becomes the leader of the conservative movement and wants halachic change, something that his predecessor Finkelstein never, ever wanted. Okay, the fourth factor, personal status versus other areas of halacha. It's one thing to say a person can drive to shul on Shabbos. When they turn the car off, when they get home in the driveway, what's done is done. It's over. But if you allow a wedding that is anti-halachic, and children are born, and you have mamzerim, or you allow adultery on the basis of a bogus get, so that's real serious material. All right, that there are long-term consequences to a change in hilchot ishut, matters of matrimony and divorce. So therefore, there's a willingness to give answers that are progressive answers on Kashrus, let's say, or Shabbos and Yom Tov, or the davening, or the synagogue setup, but a great hesitation to solve the Aguna problem. And so it festered for 40 years, from 1930 to 1969. And the inability to resolve serious issues of Hilchot Ishut, of matters of matrimony, we're eating away at the conscience of the conservative rabbis, saying, if we can't resolve this, what good are we? It's a knock on the legitimacy of historical Judaism. That if we can't solve the most pressing crisis of halakha, then our movement is not achieving what it set out to do. And that really bothered them emotionally for many, many years. Okay, but the fifth factor that led to traditionalism and the delay in Maverick rulings was the lack of unity, a diversity within the movement. Mordechai Waxman, the illustrious rabbi of Temple Israel of Great Neck, okay, my hometown, I remember seeing Waxman many, many times around town, Middle Neck Road. He was a giant of the movement. And in 1958, he wrote a book, Tradition and Change. It's available in the library, but all the libraries have it, that book. Tradition. It was a compilation of essays about from many, many authors within the movement about tradition and change. Well, where does the movement stand? And Waxman said, for 50 years, we've been hemming and hawing about doing this, doing that, and we haven't done enough. You know what? We're not even a movement. He says, we're not a movement. Everyone says we're a movement. We're not a movement. We're not moving anywhere. All right? We're stagnant. We're static. And he complained about that. So what did he say? We need change. Good, bad, or indifferent, we need change. Just to show that we are a movement. We're going somewhere. But why was it so difficult? Because nobody agreed on things. You had left-wingers who had a pantheistic view of religion, who were disciples of Kaplan, Reconstructionists, who believed in folkways, did not believe in mitzvot. You had right-wingers who believed in the divine origins of the Torah, some even believed in direct verbal revelation to Moses, or at least believed in Ruach HaKodesh, and the sacred character of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. So if you have someone on the one hand who believes almost nothing, and on the other hand, you have someone who believes in the Torah Sheba'al Peh having divine sanction, how can you have cooperation in such a wide, big tent? You can't. You're going to have polarization leading to paralysis, going nowhere. That was the struggle. Kaplan said in 1949 that in the 50 years since he graduated from the seminary, the halachic arm of the movement had issued rulings no differently than a village dying in Lithuania. Those were his exact words. Now, he's exaggerating a little bit, but only a little bit. And he's complaining. He's complaining we have not done enough. And why have we not done enough? Because we don't agree on things. And if we don't agree on things, then one side will feel alienated. No, but the Orthodox don't have that problem. I'll tell you why. Because in the Orthodox world, you don't have a catch-all organization that represents everyone from Satmar to Avi Weiss. You don't have that.
That's that little short of Avi Weiss.
You have
five, six different Orthodox.
You have the Agudas Rabbanim, the Igud Rabbanim, the Stadrus Rabbanim. You have different organizations. And so each group roughly represents a certain strand of orthodoxy. But within the conservative movement, where you have one seminary, one rabbinical organization, one synagogue union, yet you have people of wildly different views, how can you have a collaborative effort? It's nearly impossible.
Yeah. I think you're missing out a little bit on the demographics, because a lot of the people from the conservative were orthodox from their parents or their grandparents.
And
they didn't want to change the tradition as much.
Okay.
But as it went on further generation, they didn't have that connection to the
Okay. parents. So at the level of the laity, you're right on target, which is why many synagogues within the movement were loath to introduce egalitarianism and other departures from tradition. And so those synagogues held on till late in the century. And then either they went out of business or even they acquiesced to the changes that were going on everywhere else. But each synagogue was its own story, because if the laity had power, it's whatever they want. Or the rabbi might have had power, and the rabbi might have been a very traditional fellow. And the Mora d'Asra, the Mora d'Atra, the local rabbi, in the conservative movement is afforded a great degree of authority. Because in the post-48 era, you could have multiple answers to the same halakhic question. Majority view and minority view. And very often, the majority view was the traditional one in the 1950s, and the minority view was the the maverick position, and by the 70s, you flip it around, the majority view was the maverick position, and the minority view was the traditional one, but the minority view remains a valid point of view, and for the local rabbi to insist upon the standards that have been in place in his synagogue from time immemorial, he can get away with that so long as the lay people let him get away with it. But when those people retire, it's a lost cause, yeah.
All of this is very not surprising, because the conservative movement doesn't have an accepted core set of values.
Okay, so you just touched upon something that was a real bone of contention in the movement for a long time. Should they establish, like the Reform did in Pittsburgh in 1885 and Columbus in 1937, a platform? Should there be a theological platform of conservative Judaism? And for the longest time, any effort in that direction was suppressed, okay, because, number one, it would be impossible to have one platform that everybody agreed upon. And secondly, the traditionalists were horribly afraid that the real theological beliefs of the left-wingers would be exposed. And those beliefs are so far removed, so distant from the traditional Judaism, they make a mockery out of it. So it wasn't until 1988 that this actually happened. In 1985, the United Synagogue and the other constituent organizations of the movement get together, and they form a committee, and Robert Gordas, okay, one of the most illustrious conservative rabbis in the 20th century, Robert Gordas, who was from Rockaway Park, not too far from here. He was a professor of Bible at the seminary, a great author, a great scholar. He was, in his old age, made the chairman of this committee on the platform for conservative Judaism. And just around the time he died, in 1988, they put out Emet ve'emunah. You can buy it. It's available on Amazon. It's about a 30-page platform. It's a blue cover with the symbol of the seminary on the front. The bush was not consumed. Emet ve'emunah. And what does it say? It says whatever you want it to say. Basically, every strand of theological thinking within the movement is thrown a bone in that platform, so that it doesn't actually articulate some coherent view. It couldn't, because even in the mid-80s, there was still diversity of position on theology and even on halacha. Okay, so we'll stop for now, and next week, we'll address the Aguna crisis from the standpoint of the conservative movement and how that Aguna issue leads to the possibility of cooperation with the Orthodox in America, but sadly, the failure in that cooperation, and how the various strategies that were employed by the conservative movement are later employed in the Orthodox world, give or take a little minor differences, as recently as modern times.